So the title of the talk tonight is The Way You Live Your Life. And another variation on that that was coming up was The Way You Walk the Way. The way you live this life. The way you live this way. We could also say. I'll stop soon. I was remembering how, after giving my first Dharma talk, which was in this hall a few years ago, I had this feeling afterwards of, okay, that's it. I'll never be able to give another talk because I've said everything I have to say. I've used up all the good stories from my life. I've given all the examples. Nothing left to say unless I just repeat that again and again and again. And we could say to a degree, if you've heard a lot of Dharma talks, you could actually feel that, yeah, they're all saying the same thing again and again and again. Hopefully with a variation on the stories and the jokes. Not always. But reflecting on it since, I kind of feel how much I underestimated life when I felt that. That sense of, that's it. I've lived 30-something years and I've spoken about everything that I could speak of in 1 hour from those 30-something years. And so I'm always amazed at the richness of life. How much more comes, how many teachings there are, not just in things that are happening now, but also memories that come, bubbles that pop up, understandings that show themselves a long time after the actual event. So it seems really that it's probably unending. I haven't given that many talks yet, so I'm not sure, but it's probably unending. I was also reminded of visiting a friend this summer. And it's a friend that Christopher introduced me to a couple of years ago. And I just happened to be in the area, and he said, come for lunch. So I went. And he's a very special man in his 70s. And I didn't really know where I was going. I didn't know much about his life. And I came. And he said, let me show you around. And so we walked around his home, which happened to be a farm that he's lived in since the 60s. And he was showing me the garden and the apple trees that he'd planted. And we went in, and he was in the process of putting together an exhibition of his wife's paintings. His wife had passed away the previous year. And the paintings were everywhere, all over the house. And one of his students was there. She'd come for the weekend to receive some mentoring from him. He's a Jungian analyst. And then we had lunch, and it was all these vegetables that had come from his garden and the neighbor's garden. And his son-in-law was there also talking about stuff. And I was drinking some ginger beer that his son had made. And I don't know if you're getting the feeling yet, but I had this sense that I haven't had many times in my life of someone's life just being presented to me. Not being spoken about, not being told, not a story, but just, this is my life. All these things that are part of me just laid out here and just walk in, have lunch. And it gave me a sense of richness, of abundance, of what a human life can be. and of how unique it is to actually meet someone in that way. Not just one part of the person, which is what typically happens, not just a fragment of me or you. Tsar, the Dharma teacher, the daughter, the carer, whatever it is, not just a fragment, but a wholeness, a richness, an abundance. And I remember leaving, being picked up by a friend and going on and feeling the sense of happiness and joy from that meeting with that richness of a life. And at that point, not even having much clarity about what it was. But later, really going back to this reflection of what makes up a life. What makes up a human life? What makes up my life? And going back to the question I was asking on the first night in the opening talk, I don't even remember what the words were. Why am I here? What is this life about? What is my life about? And like I said the other night, it feels like that's a question that's worth asking again and again. And again and again. So that at any point when we look at our lives, we can see this richness. Another image that's been coming is of something that's woven, a tapestry of colors and textures. Lots of threads coming together. Not one thing, not one fragment, but a wholeness. In Anandawan, the leprosy community that we spend time in, there's a wonderful room where people weave all kinds of materials. Thank you. I much prefer this light. And there's a sound of the weaving happening. And when you look closely at the weavers, they're all different. Some of them don't see very well, or at all. Some of them are missing fingers. But there's a sense of a growth, a creation in there. And I really love that room and the story it tells of our potential to create beauty and usefulness, even without perfect tools. And it brings me back to something Christopher said last night. For me, the main thing he said last night, that urgent encouragement not to wait. We don't need to be perfect or perfected in order to live a full life. We can live a full life with everything we have and everything we're missing, with or without eyes, with or without fingers. We can, we are, actually. We already are. And I feel that for me, What has been so useful and so precious is this understanding of not waiting, of taking life's invitation to live, to weave, to find out what makes up my tapestry, and to take it on. On our website, we have this Pema Chodron quote. Pema Chodron is a teacher in the Tibetan tradition. And she says, "We work on ourselves in order to help others, out of love for all. And also, we help others in order to work on ourselves, as a way of working on ourselves." Does anyone have a problem with that quote? Feel free to say if you do. Nothing is holy here, I think. So sometimes people have found it problematic, this second part of we help others in order to work on ourselves, as if we're using other people's suffering. But if no one has a problem with that, I'm glad. Because I'm sure that's not what she meant. And I was reflecting on what is it that stops us from taking that step into life? What is it that stops us from opening to suffering around us, to opening our ears, our eyes, our hearts? And two things came. I'm just going to take a sidetrack and say I'm having an experiment today of having bullet points in front of me, which I haven't done for a while, and I don't like, so I'm going to stop. I might pull it out again. So what stops us for making our practice and our lives one? And one answer that came for me was not knowing what to do, not knowing how to respond, or what is a wise response. And so feeling, I need to meditate more, I need to understand more, I need more wisdom, more clarity, I need more calm abiding, ability to be with, before I step out. Another reason can be feeling helpless. What can I do? I'm only small. And another reason can be fear of contacting pain, fear of contacting suffering, of actually coming into contact with that which we spend so much of our time running away from. And so I feel like we need to give space for those reasons. They're not unimportant or unreal. But what happens in our experience when we do step forward? When we do come close to life in all its manifestations? And also, I was wondering if we actually have a choice. Can we actually avoid suffering? Can we actually avoid anxiety or pain? Can we? Has anyone found a way?
Maybe that guy.
Maybe he did. But do you think he was avoiding? So what was he doing?
Seeing through it.
Yeah. And so my experience, at least, has been that to see through some pain, certainly not seen beyond it yet, I have to come close. I have to open my eyes and look. I can't do it by hiding. And I've been noticing in myself, just the last few days, when something is difficult, how much of my energy goes towards trying to get away from it. And it's like this, there's actually feeling the vibration, the movement, whether it's internal or external, whether it's actually physically running away or just internally running away. And it's like a glass that has water and some kind of particles in it, constantly being shaken, 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 shaken. We can never see through that. But what happens if I can be a little stiller, a bit quieter, and things can settle? And so in a way, it feels that that vulnerability that we all have is where we need to stand. That fragility of life, in life, is our resting place. And sometimes, and I'm going to give some examples soon, it feels like something in life wakes us up. Calls us to connect, to look. And we all have different ways of responding. But the importance is in being open to hear that invitation, that call. And I have three examples. We all know the example of this guy behind me. Three other examples. More simple maybe. So the first one, is a story from a British soldier in World War II. So he was part of a group that liberated a concentration camp. And I read a piece by him where he was saying it was a women's camp. Just how difficult it was to be there and deal with the reality, which was beyond anybody's nightmare. And that the most difficult thing wasn't just the suffering, but the helplessness that the soldiers were in, because here were people needing, desperately needing, food and medicine. And they had nothing. They just had what they had for themselves, which was shared within a few hours, if not a few minutes. And so they were desperately waiting all the time for shipments of medical supplies and food to come from the US, from Europe, from other parts of Europe. And people dying every second. And so he said every parcel, every package that came was an excitement, and they couldn't wait to open and get the stuff out and use it. And one day they opened one of the boxes and it was full of lipsticks, makeup. And they were like, good God. Good God, you know, people dying. And someone sends us lipsticks. Is this like a really bad joke? And so they just put it to one side. But somehow, the lipsticks got out. And suddenly they started seeing all these women in the camp with lipstick on their lips, including the ones in the hospitals dying. And he said, it really taught him something about humanity and about life and about what matters. And how with that lipstick, these women were transformed from just another number, another prisoner, into a human being for themselves, into a woman. They were given something which was possibly as important as food. They were given their sense of being a human being. And so we, each of us, can feel what this story means to us. What does it do to us? What does it open? I happened to read it on the website of the British artist Banksy, for those who know him. And he had it on the website because this piece of writing was what inspired him to become an artist. So many years later. And to be a very unique artist. An artist whose mission is to give dignity to all human beings in whatever situation. One of the most beautiful for me works of art that he's done is some graffiti on the separation barrier that Israel has built between Israel and Palestine. Taking something which is a horror and putting beauty and humor into it. So taking the suffering in life and changing it in his own unique way. Finding his way to change. One of his paintings is a ladder all the way up the wall. So another story, another example. Also read this one on the internet. I don't spend that much time on the internet, I promise. This is from someone who was a major in the Israeli army. And doing his job, which happened to be, amongst other things, policing Palestinian civilian population. And he said one day they'd had a tough night, and the next day they had to put a curfew on a whole Palestinian village. And so he was at an observation point where he could watch the village, make sure that no one was escaping or whatever, I don't know. And he was talking to his wife on his cell phone. And his wife was telling him how she was finding it very difficult to find someone to pick up their 5-year-old daughter from kindergarten that day. And so he was talking to his wife and concerned about his 5-year-old daughter. And he was watching the village. And what he saw in the village was 2 little girls, same age as his daughter, more or less, playing. Playing on the pile of rubble, which was the blockade that the army had put to keep the village in curfew. And something changed. Something dropped. And he could suddenly see, very clearly, he writes, that there was no difference between those 2 Palestinian girls and his daughter. Same. So he could see the suffering that he had been blind to before. And so what he did was resign from the Israeli army and found an organization called Combatants for Peace, where Jews and Palestinians who were actively involved in violently fighting each other are now working together towards nonviolent solutions. And that's been his life mission. And so I'm feeling to share these stories that I've found inspiring, that I've been touched by, to kind of give us a taste of what our own potential is. When we can find what helps us drop whatever it is that's keeping us moving away from. And I have another story. This one's lighter. Yesterday I was walking from the place where I'm staying to here for the morning meditation. And when I arrived, I discovered I only had one of my shawls, not both. And the one that wasn't there is a favorite shawl. And so I didn't have time to go and look for it, and I just came here. And on the way back, I was looking for it. And at some point, when I saw that I'd gotten through the monastery and the road, and I just had that part through the village, if people know the way from here to Namabuddha, where the great breakfast is, it's like really through the houses, through the village, where a lot of poor people live. So I thought, well, probably if I dropped it there, it won't be there anymore. Someone's picked it up. And I thought, okay, well, I really like that shawl, but probably if someone's picked it up, they're going to use it. So it's still going to be used. It's still going to be appreciated. And so I was walking through, winding my way, And at some point, I was just about to disappear into a gap between two houses when I heard someone calling, "Hello, hello." And I swear, I usually don't turn around. But I did. And I could see that on the other side of a washing line, there was a woman. And so I kind of bent down to look at her, and she bent down to look at me. And she pointed. And my shawl was hanging up on her washing line. And so I thanked her, and I took it, and I walked away. And I told Nathan as soon as I arrived, because I was so touched by this. Like, why? You know, why did she do that? Keep an eye out for me to come back and give it to me. I mean, obviously she needs it much more than me. And we were kind of talking about, well, what do we do? How do we really thank her? I mean, I did really thank her, but what do we do? Do we go back and give her some money? Do we buy her a gift? What do we do? And I still haven't got an answer, but the sense I was getting was that I take that with me. And that gratitude can show itself in so many ways. And that's part of this web of life. This tapestry is not just our life. So it's not just about showing gratitude to her. The gratitude can come to someone else in another way. It will come, it has to. And so I feel like I've given three very different examples, maybe, but also very similar in the way of this call and response. Like classical devotional singing, call and response, life calling, and how do we respond? So many ways for all of us, for each of us. And I have this great quote from one of Nathan's guitar books. And this quote says, "Be mindful of what you do. Because whatever you do a lot of, you will get good at." Brilliant. Be careful of what you do. Because whatever you do a lot of, you will get good at. So again, what threads do we weave our life from? What do we want to be good at? What do we want life to be good at? Because it's not just about us. It's what qualities do we bring into life? Another image that comes to me a lot recently is an image of crossing invisible borders. With that same kind of happening that happens when we see something for real, or we lose this veil which stops us seeing life as it is. And again, I can say in being in Israel and moving into Palestine, this is very real, this image that I have. It's not out of the blue that this image is there. Invisible borders. And how hard it is for each of us to cross these borders for ourselves. Because we're almost not aware they're there. We know, but we almost don't know. And yet, how good it feels when we let ourselves see the borders and when we let ourselves cross the borders. That delight that Christopher was speaking about yesterday, which has a different taste. It's not a pleasure. It's not about pleasure. It's about being in touch with something true, something real. In a way, it's like giving a Dharma talk, which is also something I often wonder why I do. Because it's not a pleasant experience. But it's a delightful experience. It has this sense of being very focused, which doesn't always feel pleasant, but it's very real. Very, very real. Sometimes I have this image of like being in a pot being boiled, being cooked. The fire, you feel the fire. Yeah? The fire is there. But what keeps me going is the sense of knowing I'm being cooked. That life is happening, that this process is happening, it's unfolding. And it's what I'm alive for. I'm not alive for pleasure only, but for this delight, this depth. And it was a very interesting discovery for me, this discovery, that it doesn't mean, doing this doesn't mean bliss all the time, most of the time maybe. It varies from person to person. It might mean bliss for you. It can mean this kind of intensity. And can I open to that? Because I want to be cooked. I so much want to be cooked. So much. I'm going to give another little example of this, which was doing a short, probably 36-hour retreat with 10 Israelis in October, going into Palestine. And this again brings us back to the invisible borders. And this is a retreat, we've done this 15 days, many, many times, with groups of Israelis and internationals mixed. And the same thing, Chris has been to all of them. He's our walking advertisement. But this last time in Israel, both Nathan and I had a feeling we want to do one, just a weekend, short, people can come, just for Israelis. Just for Israelis. And Nathan chose not to come so that we could do it in Hebrew. Just Israelis. And how different it was. 40-minute drive from Tel Aviv to Palestinian village. Most people in the group either never been to Palestine or only been to Palestine during their military service. And what it took from people to do that, to cross that border, to actually make that commitment to be in Palestine for, I think we were actually in Palestine for less than 24 hours. And what happened when we did? So arriving and feeling the fear and feeling the discomfort And I wasn't sure what was going to happen. What happens? How are people going to react in the village? Just Israelis. And are we going to go out and sit in the cafe like we always do with the international group or not? And what are people going to do when they see a group of 12 Israelis there speaking Hebrew? What are they going to think? But we did. Because, you know, that's what you do. And some people wouldn't speak to us. And some people would only speak English to us. And then one guy came. Do you remember this, Faith? You remember this? One guy came. He looked about 17 years old. And he was all happy. Happy, happy, happy. And he said, in Hebrew, "You're Israelis?" He said, "Yeah." "You're all Israelis?" "Yeah." "What are you doing here?" "Picking olives." And just chatting. And after a while, one of us said to him, "Well, how come you know such good Hebrew?" And he said, "I just got out of prison 6 months ago." "Oh, yeah. How long were you in prison for?" "2 years." "What did you do?" He said, "It doesn't matter." But we just carried on talking. And it felt like that courage from both sides to cross that border. And what he gave us was incredible. And the fact that he could actually be happy to see us. And so the next day we went out olive harvesting with different families. So the group was split up and went out with different families. And in the afternoon, when we came back to the house, what struck me was the complete transformation of every single person in the group. What had been tense was relaxed. Where there had been fear, there was a sense of connection. And people felt like this very small thing, this 40-minute drive, and giving 30 hours of their lives changed something very important. And I could feel it. They didn't even need to say. You could just see it in their faces. And some of these people are now carrying on their relationship with that village and other villages. So how we keep the wheel of Dharma moving, how we keep the wheel of love moving, how we keep the wheel of connection, of care, of compassion, of everything that matters to us moving. So the way we live our life really matters, not only to us. It's not just about my life. It's not just about my life. It's about all of life. And we have choices all the time. I was working this summer with an old man in his late 80s who had suffered from a lot of strokes. And so he had lost the ability to move one side of his body and he couldn't speak anymore. He could understand, but he couldn't speak. He couldn't formulate language. And he was a Quaker and he was a musician and a music teacher. And he'd spent his life supporting others in his community. And I've worked with a lot of people in similar situations. But what struck me about this man and his life was that even though he was in such a disconnected physical situation, and it was so hard to be with him because of that, people still came. His violin students came to play to him because he couldn't play for himself anymore. And his friends came to visit him. And his brothers in Denmark would phone and sing to him on the phone because they couldn't have a conversation. They would sing to him. And he would get sometimes very frustrated with his condition, as we can all imagine. And especially in the evenings when he had a lot of energy and he wanted to walk around. And yet, it was tricky because he could also at any moment run out of energy and fall. So we would always have to have these negotiations. And sometimes we would both be very frustrated, even angry with each other, squabbling. And many times when we were in that situation, he would just reach out his arms and hug me. Just reach out his arms and hug me. And that felt like a result of many choices he'd made during his life. That even in that situation of so much frustration, of unbearable suffering, and of me telling him, "No, Keld, we cannot go outside now. And I'm half his age, even less," of me being in control, he could see beyond that and hug. He could offer the healing to that conflict. And he passed away a few weeks ago, but he really left me with that. And so again, those choices of how we live our life, of what matters in our life, and how we bring that into ourselves, and how that is offered to everyone. And I'd like to end with a poem. And this poem is called "Lingering in Happiness." And it's by Mary Oliver. And please remember the title, "Lingering in Happiness." It's beautiful. And she says, "After rain, after many days without rain, it stays cool, private and cleansed under the trees. And the dampness there, married now to gravity, falls branch to branch, leaf to leaf, down to the ground, where it will disappear, but not vanish, except to our eyes. It will disappear but not vanish, except to our eyes. The roots of the oaks will have their share, and the white threads of the grasses, and the cushion of moss. A few drops, round as pearls, will enter the mole's tunnel, and soon, so many small stones, buried for 1,000 years, will feel themselves being touched." So many small stones, buried for 1,000 years, will feel themselves being touched. So let's have a few quiet moments. May all beings feel the bounty of rain after many days without rain. May all the stones, may all the hearts be touched by life, by our lives. And may all beings know what it is to linger in happiness. Thank you for your listening.